Welcome to another author interview on Read It or List It. I'm Phoebe.
And I'm Ashley.
And in today's interview, we are so pleased to welcome the one and only Matt Haig. Matt's new book, The Midnight Library, released in September 2020 and has been absolutely everywhere. It is such a good book club choice, as it is one that will elicit plenty of discussion. The Midnight Library does dive into difficult topics such as suicide, choice, and regret.
The Midnight Library follows the story of Nora, who has found herself feeling like her life is going from bad to worse. At the stroke of midnight on her last night on Earth, she finds herself in a library, but not just any library, the Midnight Library, where she is given the choice to undo the choices she regrets making or missing out on. It raises the question, with infinite choices, which is the best life to live?
As always, we want to protect our listeners and provide you with some context for this interview. While it is still hopeful and uplifting, this interview does touch on Matt's own journey with depression and suicidal thoughts. If you find this to be triggering, please join us in another episode.
Here is Phoebe's conversation with Matt Haig.
We are so excited to welcome the wonderful, amazing Matt Haig to Read It or List It today. It is so wonderful to have you. Obviously, I'm sure our listeners know exactly who you are and your mission and your books, but we would love if you could begin by telling our listeners just a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, I'm Matt. I'm a British author. I am 45 years old. I have been writing for, I've never really had a proper job. So I think in Britain, my first published book was when I was 26 years old. I've written lots of books, a depressing amount of books. I think the Midnight Library, someone once said, recently said on Instagram, I saw them because it tagged me. They said, I've read your first book, The Midnight Library. The Midnight Library is book number 20 in my writing life. So although a good few of my early books were hardly read by anyone beyond my immediate family members, I have technically written 20 books. So I've been, you know, Mr. Struggling Writer for a long time. And then I think book number 10 was a book called Reasons to Stay Alive, which was my first non-fiction, because I write some non-fiction as well. And that was the first time I spoke about my experience of depression and panic disorder when I was in my 20s and I became suicidal, and I was in a very ill place for about 3 years, and then a sort of long meandering roller coaster recovery. I still wouldn't say I'm like in nirvana. I'm not like 100% perfectly well, and I always state that because I feel like actually the thing that used to make me worse was the binary belief that you were either 100% well or you're 100% ill. And I see mental health as a kind of like a garden that you kind of have to tend to continually. And that's a good thing, because you end up having a better life because of it, because you're being mindful of how you're feeling all the time and stuff like that. So it's something I have to be aware of. And yeah, I've written children's books, adult books, most recently The Midnight Library, which is doing better by my standards than most of my books, certainly in America especially. So it's so nice to be properly feeling like I've got real support on your side of the Atlantic. And it's exciting.
Yes, we are very grateful for your words, especially this year. I think The Midnight Library is one that is so poignant for so many people, especially because I know that you had this idea for a while, being fascinated by, you know, how many, I always think of, I mean, and you quote Robert Frost in your book as well, the road that diverged in the wood, and you take the one less traveled, and the possibility that we all could have these different lives. But you know,
I will never shy away from an overused quote. My books are basically collections of my favorite quotes, and yes. I put it all in there. And borrow their wisdom to reflect well on me. That's my tactic. Anyway, sorry, I cut you off rudely.
No, not at all. I'm also someone who is very inspired by words. I'm an actor in my non-reading life. I'm So this particularly, this book was very poignant for me because my whole life trajectory has changed due to the coronavirus pandemic, with Broadway being shut down and, you know, things, it's just very hard to continue on right now. So do you think that this book coming out in 2020 and obviously, like, do you think it was just, it hit people differently? It was a more poignant in the age of the coronavirus.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, I dread some conspiracy theory emerging that this was all my doing, my evil doing. No, it's interesting, though, because I obviously wrote the bulk of this book in 2019 before I'd heard the word COVID and before I knew anything about it. But my last edit on this book was March 2020. So, and that at that point, Britain, because we were a bit ahead of you, ahead of the States in terms of when we switched into sort of panic attack mode.
Yes, but if we all could have just learned from everybody else.
Well, I know, same with us, actually. I mean, obviously, you guys were slow, but we were, you know, equally rubbish at being alert and aware. Well, not individually, but, you know, government. Yes. And, yeah, so we saw it spreading across Europe, Italy, Spain. Italy was like nightmare zone of France. And then, yeah, it was really kicking in Britain when I was editing the book. So I had a sort of thought at one point. I thought, should I be mentioning this new reality? Should I actually mention the pandemic within the novel? And I quickly dismissed that and I thought, no, I shouldn't, because I wrote this in 2019 before the pandemic. Anything would just feel sort of tacked on. Or I, at that point, I didn't know, no one knew how long this was going to last. And I've learned over the years that if you're putting too much of contemporary news or contemporary life in your novel, there's no quicker way to date a novel than, especially a contemporary novel, if you put too much news references in. Obviously, there are times when it's warranted, depending on the topic of the book, if you're writing about terrorism or something. But, you know, with The Midnight Library, it just didn't seem necessary. Mm-hmm. So, but I do feel like in that last edit, I, which was quite a heavy edit, I was very much in the mind. I was panicking myself. I was worrying about my elderly parents. I was doing this, that, and the other. And I think the flavor of the time sort of seeped in a little bit anyway, on top of the fact that I think people want reads which are kind of comforting, which are about acceptance of hard times and making the most of the situation you're in, which I suppose broadly the themes. And yeah, so I think that was sort of coincidental piece of serendipity there. But.
Well, Nora is a character who really, I mean, I love her because she normalizes the idea that, you know, we all have these regrets and I think struggling is okay. And I loved that metaphor that you used earlier, that our mental health is a garden and, you know, there are spring and there's winter and, you know, you have to put in the effort for yourself and for others to take care of that mental health. And I love that, you know, it reminded me of the play Constellations by Nick Payne. I don't know if you know that play, but just this idea that, you know, there's so much potential that we have. And I just, I mean, I.
Yeah, that's a Jack Gyllenhaal, isn't it? Jake Gyllenhaal?
Yes, Jake Gyllenhaal.
Jake Gyllenhaal, yes.
Sorry. Yeah, Gyllenhaal.
Gyllenhaal, yes. My rubbish British pronunciation. And yes, and yeah, because I met Nick Payne about another book I wrote called How to Stop Time, which he was going to adapt for a little while. So yes, there's some sort of overlap in our...
It was comforting to me to find those. I'm always someone that's searching for like, what can I connect this to? And I worked on Constellation, so I knew it very well. And I love that. Just exploring the idea, not being afraid of, I think a lot of people can be afraid that if you think of, you know, if maybe I had, you know, like the idea of the saying yes to the coffee date or saying no to the coffee date, how would that have changed your life? And I love that line when she goes, must have been a successful coffee. to end up with a family and all that, but it's so lovely. And you really utilize your social media in such a positive way. I think I see one of your posts like floating around at least like 3 or 4 times a week because you have such such a way with words, and obviously you're a writer. But what inspires these words like that you send out into the universe and hope that maybe they latch on for someone else, and why the need to share them?
Yeah, well, I feel, and it might be a sentimental thought, but I think basically writing full stop, if you are being true to yourself, if you are writing something that you would sincerely want or need or like to read, if it's something that's coming from a place that you're actually feeling in that moment, it's always going to connect with somebody outside of yourself. If you know people, you know, I can remember when I was starting out as a writer, and yeah, and you read lots of advice, and you hear from agents and they say, you know, think of the market and think of this and think of a genre and read around that. And all that's valid advice. But I genuinely think you're never going to actually mind read anyone else. The only read you're truly, truly going to honestly really know is yourself. And so I feel like if you really are brutally honest with yourself about the stuff you want to put out in the world, whether it's optimism, whether it's skeptical, whatever it is, if it's coming from you, it will connect with somebody else. And ever since, it's very strange, really, but ever since I had depression, my recovery from that made me an optimist, because I had so many years where pessimism was the chief symptom of what I was going through, that I realized that not only was that pessimism dangerous because it was life-threatening, but it was also massively wrong. You know, the thoughts and the voices I had in my head when I was ill were very depressing, obviously, by their nature, but they were also 99.9% of the times inaccurate. You know, I was convinced, getting a bit dark here, trigger warning, suicidal talk, but I was convinced at the age of 24 that I wouldn't be around at the age of 25. And then you live to see your 25th birthday, you live to sort of like stay in a relationship you thought was going to crumble, but certain people don't desert you, this doesn't happen, that doesn't happen, you become 30, you become 40, you become, in my case now, 45. And that makes you optimistic, because I almost became stubbornly, sort of radically optimistic, because it wasn't necessarily always in my nature, it was something I cultivated as a sort of weapon and armor against very, very deep catastrophic pessimism. And so that's why I feel like sometimes my posts, and I'm sure they annoy some people, but sometimes they sound almost like triumphantly optimistic. It's not because I think life is all sunshine and rainbows and unicorns. It's because I know it isn't, but I know that perspective is such a key part of that. And yes, I don't believe that you can read an inspirational quote and then magically be fixed from depression or whatever it is. But I do believe that there are certain pieces of advice we hear from people or certain books we read that reframe a thought, or if not reframe something, at least make you feel less lonely. Make you feel like you're not the only one. I mean, that was my primary, when I started writing about mental health in my books, and I'd say most of my books aren't directly about mental health, but when I did start writing about mental health in my books, I think that was my first aim, really, to actually explain what it felt like, not to offer sort of magical solutions, but to explain the feelings of what it felt like, just to make people going through that feel less alone, and make people who know someone who's going through that and they feel at a loss of what to do or how to empathize, to actually, you know, to offer a little window on what is often a very invisible experience.
Yeah, I think that is so important, especially right now. I think we're all realizing how much our mental health is our physical health. And I mean, I know that anytime I see some of your words pop up, it always it doesn't matter what everyone is going through. There's some magic in those words that whatever you're experiencing in your life, you can internalize them. You know that, like, it's just a way that I feel like you have a really good way of putting a generalized idea that can become very personal for anyone who reads it. And my copy of The Midnight Library is so marked up. I have book darts all throughout it of just words and quotes that I know I'm going to be able to go back to when I need them. But that's a lot of responsibility on you. And I'm sure you are very capable of this. But any like tips how you prioritize your mental health? I know I put this little quote in here saying that you can't pour from an empty cup, but,
yeah.
You know, writing about these experiences, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, that's a lot on you. So how do you still prioritize yourself amongst your writing?
Yeah, well, I haven't always been great at that, to be honest. Like, for instance, 5 years ago when my career really took off in the UK, in England, you know, I can remember it should have been like an amazing time because I'd been a struggling writer for so long. And then all of a sudden this book, Reasons to Stay Alive, which did okay in America, but it did really well in the UK and became a number one bestseller. And it felt like a dream come true moment. And yet I was going through such a mental health dip that coincided with that. And I think it was related to it as well, because I felt like, oh, right. Okay. So this book's helping other people. I'm getting contacted by people. I'm saying it's helping them. And why can't my own advice work on myself? And I was having this sort of existential crisis. And I felt, in a really strange place with it. And it was very draining getting back to people, because a lot of the messages I was getting were the kind of messages, even though they were from strangers, that I couldn't really ignore, because it was a lot of vulnerable people. In one or two cases, it was like, you know, people in serious or immediate danger. And so it was like, suddenly it felt like, oh my goodness, you know, I'm just a writer. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychotherapist. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm just a person who went through an experience, who wrote about that experience. And it was, that year was very hard. And I had to get lots of sort of advice from local mental health charities. And, you know, I'm much better at dealing with that, knowing where my boundaries are and should be. And yeah, I'm a lot better. And if that means occasionally not looking at messages, it means not looking at messages, but being very clear with people that I can't answer everything or get back to things. And, you know, boundaries, which I've always been bad at with my own personal sort of boundaries. I've had to get used to saying no to things, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, again, going back to the early days where you're just grateful to get for anything, you say yes in your early times of your career, you get yourself out there, every bit of local press, this, that and the other. And you just can't do that forever, especially if, you know, if you suddenly in demand and being asked for things. So I've learned to have space for myself and not to feel guilty about it, not to mm-hmm. feel guilty about every single unanswered email, not to feel, you know, I think one reason I've written 20 books is because I've been quite a workaholic and I've been bad at work-life balance. And I'm starting to get better at work-life balance and to realize that I don't need to be validating my existence all the time by creating and doing. I can actually just sort of sit back and absorb and be, and that's perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm. I think that will resonate with a lot of people. We are big fans of boundaries here, we that are listed, and understanding that. But so of all of the 20 books that you've written going from fiction to nonfiction and your children's books that are absolutely lovely. I had a friend of mine, I was like, I'm going to let you in a secret. I'm interviewing Matt Haig this week. And she was like, I would do anything. I love him. She's read all of your books and is a huge, huge fan.
Oh, wow.
Particularly of the children's books, even reading them as an adult. So do you have a favorite genre, or those would be considered genres that you write?
I don't really. I mean, what I really like and what I'm try and do with each book is to try and make each book feel like it's got something new about it. Not necessarily new in the wide world of books, but at least new in my, in terms of my own career. And because if you have that little bit of excitement, almost like a debut each time, whether that's because you're switching to a new genre or you're doing something different. So The Midnight Library, I suppose, that was the first time in fiction I'd spoken about stuff that I normally speak about in nonfiction. So speaking directly about the mental health stuff. And that gave it a sort of new feel for me writing it. But I feel like there has to be something fresh and exciting for me writing it. So, because I get bored very easily, which is, you know, probably comes across in my fiction where I have super short chapters. I like short sentences. I like short paragraphs. And, I'm very conscious of 21st century attention spans, because I've got a 21st century attention span where we're in this world of distraction and we're freaking screens. So I suppose if there's a sort of theme or genre, I suppose a lot, certainly in terms of fiction, my fictional books have one foot in reality and one foot in fantasy. So I'm never pure sort of like Tolkien, Lord of the Rings or Narnia. It's never pure fantasy. It's always like, I like that space in speculative fiction between a real world and a fantasy setting. So The Midnight Library very obviously is that. And a lot of my adult novels have that. I think I've only written one book that could be classed as properly realist fiction. That was a book that no one read, called The Possession of Mr. Cave, which was my darkest, it's the darkest book I ever wrote. It's so pessimistic. And even though I think actually it's one of my better books in terms of the actual quality of the writing in it, I can't actually look at that book now, because I was still depressed when I was writing it. And it's just, you know, unhappy ending, unhappy middle, unhappy beginning. And it's like, why did I put that out in the world? Anyway, but generally I'm sort of like halfway in reality and halfway into sort of dream world. But that's how I kind of feel.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like this like dreamscape idea I think that, I mean, that's what I loved about it, that, you know, we all have a midnight library, and we can all go there and find these little nuggets of wisdom. But speaking of that idea of this dreamscape, so we obviously have the character Mrs. Elm, who guides Nora through the midnight library. She's the librarian. If you had anyone in your life, who would you envision as your Mrs. Elm in your midnight library?
Well, actually, Mrs. Elm was a sort of an amalgam of people who have been in my life. And obviously, there's a bit of fiction in there, too. But I mean, my grandmother, who died 22, 23, 24 years ago. But I can remember vividly as a child, my grandmother, because she used to live in the annex joined onto our house. And she has that combination which Mrs. Elm has of love and toughness. Like, she was kind of like tough with us as children. I mean, she was lovely as well, and I can remember going into the forest and she used to take us on hunts for elderflower, and we'd go back and make this lovely elderflower cordial, which tasted like heaven, and it was very nice. I can't remember the recipe, but it was a very simple thing that she used to do with us. And we used to have lots of outside experiences in forests, and she seemed to have infinite knowledge, but she was very sort of tough. I can remember once we had friends round, and she was babysitting, and we were sort of giggling with my friends in the room and being too loud, and she came up, and I can picture her silhouette, and she was like, you know, it's almost not quite Mrs. Trunchbull, but she was kind of like very strict with us as well, but in a way which was it was always coming from a position of love. And so Mrs. Elm's got that tough love thing going on. And also, there was a teacher, an English teacher, a literature teacher I had at what we call secondary school, senior school. And she was great. She was the first person I showed my writing to. It's a woman called Mrs. Kurzweil, and she had a lot of a Mrs. Elm in her too. And she was the one, when I was very insecure as a teenager and didn't really sort of show off about reading and certainly not show off about writing, I sort of secretly showed her stuff I was writing, and she was very nice about it and gave me confidence at a time I didn't have much confidence. So there's definitely a bit of her in her too. So yeah, English teacher and my grandmother.
Love that. All right, I know you have a busy schedule today, so just one final question and then we'll wrap up. Something that we love to do here is find song pairings for books. So when I was reading this book, I couldn't help but think of the song Hold On. So is there a song that you think of when you think of the Midnight Library, or do you have like a writing playlist or anything like that?
Ah, that's a good question. Normally, you see, with a book, certainly with a novel, I do actually have a certain song in mind. Like I wrote a book called The Humans, which I had the song, This Must Be the Place by Talking Heads was the song that I had in mind. I wrote How to Stop Time. There was The Boys of Summer by Don Henley I had in mind. With The Midnight Library, it's not necessarily a song, but it's more an instrument. I had the piano in mind because obviously she teaches piano. I was relearning the piano via an app as I was writing Midnight Library, and I was sort of like trying to play very badly a lot of classical and pop music while I was doing it. And I feel like, I don't know, piano.
I think piano, that fits.
Like the chessboard in there, but the piano is a perfect metaphor, isn't it? Because you can literally go anywhere when you've got those keys in front of you, as you can in life. And
it can be in tune or out of tune.
In tune,
like one note out of tune can throw everything.
Yeah,
off.
Or you can play a chord and hit those notes at a parallel, simultaneous time. Piano chords.
I love that. All right, Matt. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners?
If you ever want to write your own books, my advice would be to really, really trust your own judgment, because for years in my career, I was often told to go a certain way or be like a certain other author. And it did take me a long time to find my own space and have my own niche, but I feel like I finally got there, and I wouldn't have got there without sticking to my guns and actually liking what I like. And it's okay to write things or to read things that you know not everyone is going to have the same taste, or not everyone is not necessarily for everybody. You don't need to write for everybody. And you essentially just need to write deeply for yourself, and hopefully that will connect with other people, and then you will find your tribe. And that's the nicest thing about being a writer, is you actually can put yourself, even if it's just your fantasy imagination self, out there on paper, and then you find a sort of community of like-minded people in this day and age for social media and stuff like that, who are along the same wavelength. And that's the nicest thing about writing. And also, I'll just say, you know, there's a cliche about bookish people being introverted or shy or, you know, wallflowers and antisocial. And actually, I think the opposite is true, because I think books are our deepest form of socializing. And I feel like, you know, often we'll be socializing with someone who died in the 19th century, and we will be socializing with, I don't know, Tolstoy or the Brontes or something, but we are connecting to another mind and another human being, and it's not about ourselves necessarily. It's a way of connecting and viewing the world and becoming part of that world again. And so I think reading and writing to a lesser degree is a kind of love in action and a way of connecting with people. So that's my little ramble.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. The Midnight Library is available wherever you get your books. And thank you again for joining me, Matt.
Thank you, Phoebe. It's been so kind of you for having me.
I mean, you know how I felt after speaking with him. I sent Ashley a video of me crying because this interview with Matt just totally filled up my soul with hopeful feelings and also a new vocabulary for dealing with my own mental health and discussing it with others. And as you know, we're currently discussing audiobooks on Read It or List It, and this is a fantastic audiobook. It is read by Carey Mulligan, who is a wonderful British accent, and even though it deals with such heavy topics, there's still, like, levity within the pages.
Yeah, I feel like a book like this lends itself really well to audio, and I think that even when, especially in a time like now where we're all collectively going through so much as a country, as a nation, having or as a world, having a book like this to soothe you with a nice accent but also like heavy hitting is perfect.
Yeah, it's a good thinking piece. So as I said earlier, The Midnight Library is available wherever you get your books. Thanks for listening.
Next time. Original music by Jake Thorne. Podcast produced and edited by me, Ashley Chandler, and Phoebe Wright. You can find us on Instagram at Read It or List It Pod. All rights reserved 2020.